You're listening to The Rick Smith Show on the Progressive Voices Network.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. It's primary day in a couple of states across the U.S., Vermont, Minnesota, Wisconsin, also I think Connecticut as well. The big race I'm watching, obviously, two in Wisconsin, the governor's race, who's going to be the Democrat running against Scott Walker, hopefully to oust him, and who wins between Randy Bryce and Kathy Myers to take Paul Ryan's seat. I think there are like five or six Republicans running to take Ryan's place. So that's going to be fun, interesting. As the numbers come in, we'll take a look at that and see how that plays out. But before we get all started, the Manafort trial over. I was expecting something, some type of a defense. I was expecting, you know, a little something. Now, I also understand that in a lot of these white-collar crime things, in a lot of these trials, the defense doesn't really put up a defense. Their defense was attacking the prosecution, and then in their closing saying, no, they didn't prove anything. That seems to be the defense. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out and when the jury gets that. Should be fun and interesting. Also, big news just a couple of minutes ago, the Kansas governor, Jeff Collier, he conceded to Kris Kobach. Kris Kobach will be the Republican nominee. He will be the Republican running for governor in Kansas. So here's a chance to pick up a governor's seat in Kansas. The Democrat should have a reasonable shot. Also, if Kobach wins, it'll be fun to watch the state devolve even further into chaos, insanity, and desperation. So get ready for the refugees to be leaving from Kansas. Now, interestingly enough, it's only the second time an incumbent governor in Kansas has lost. The last time it happened, 1956. So, yeah, there you go. All right, the big news of the day, obviously, the Trump. You know, the big distraction of the day, the Trump, the tweets. I look at the one tweet, right? First thing, just first thing in the morning. Trump tweeted out, when you give a crazed, crying lowlife a break and give her a job at the White House, I guess it just didn't work out. Good for General Kelly for quickly firing that dog. The internet's kind of went crazy because, look, Trump has a history of calling black people all kinds of names. And now this black woman, a dog, the Twitters did not take kindly, and nor should they. And as I tweeted out, this is presidential. This is the new presidential. And I'm waiting for someone to go, you know, now he has fully reached presidential heights. Yeah, but here's the thing. This is the fun part in this, in that, you know, Omarosa now, who, you know, it's that hell hath no fury thing, I kind of believe. She says, you know, she's spoken with Mueller's office. She's claiming there were tons of corruption, lots of corruption, not just in the campaign, but in the administration as well. And she has tapes. She also claims that Trump knew about the emails that were hacked from the DNC well before they were released by WikiLeaks, which, again, you know, kind of puts what we already know, kind of throws a little bit of light on what we already know. Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Now, understand, you know, Omarosa is saying that she's got audio tapes of Donald Trump using the N-word. So a reporter asked Sarah Huckabee Sanders today, can you guarantee the American people will never hear Donald Trump utter the N-word on a recording in any context? And Sarah Huckabee Sanders kind of, now understand, she's a great liar. I mean, she lies with such regularity that, you know, probably in most cases the truth would have been better, but she's good at it. I mean, she's better than, because it doesn't matter if she gets caught in it. She'll just, fake news. Even this was too far for her, evidently, because she said, I can't guarantee anything. That tells me there's a tape. That tells me it's there. So what does the Trump administration do? What does Donald do? Well, he falls back onto what Donald's always done. He's filed a lawsuit. Evidently, he today has filed a lawsuit against Omarosa because she evidently, according to him, he claims, violated their non-disclosure agreement, which she signed during the campaign in 2016. Now, if this were the non-disclosure agreement that I guess they tried to get her to force while she worked in the White House, I don't think there's no way that that stands. The interesting part of this, it's the campaign. I wouldn't think it should stand, but it will be interesting to see how this plays out. Now, there's part of me that goes, you know, eventually she may win, but this is about nothing more than chewing up a bunch of resources. This is nothing but getting her to spend a lot of money on defending this suit. But here's the difference. When Trump was private citizen Trump, you know, when screwing contractors and cheating everybody he could, you know, this kind of hardball worked really well because most people couldn't afford to fight. He's president now. There are tons of lawyers who would go, you know what, I'll do it for free just so I can get my name in the paper every single day. Michael Avenatti, they're actually talking about him as running for president because he represented a porn star who had sex with Donald Trump. That's how low the bar now is to get somebody running for president. So, yeah, lots of fun there. I'm actually looking forward to more fun and entertainment on the Omarosa front. Are there tapes? I believe so. Will they matter? No. So all of my liberal and progressive friends, all of my Democratic friends who think, oh, this is finally going to bring Trump down. No, it's not. No. Look, everything we already know, there is literally nothing that can be on these tapes, in my view, that brings him down. It just solidifies what we already know and what we already believe in him. And the right, you know, the base going, yeah, damn right, should be able to say it. It's just, it's the world in which we live. So lots of fun there. Now, RNC chairman, or chairwoman, sorry, Miss McDaniel. She had an interesting quote today that it was one of those things that just, you know, kind of grabbed me. And, you know, it's, you know, her premise was that Republicans have a winning formula. They have a winning formula of results and not resisting. That was her thing. She goes, well, you know, it's something that energizes our base to look at Nancy Pelosi and how out of touch she is. She called these tax cuts and these bonuses and these higher paychecks that people are feeling crumbs. She said the tax cuts were going to be Armageddon. And then you look at Maxine Waters, who's already called for impeachment proceedings. She has called for violence and crowds to assemble around cabinet members or officials of the Republican Party. This is not what where we want our country to go. So they represent the extreme of the Democrat Party. They represent what leadership would mean in that party. And then you contrast it with the results that you've seen from the Republican leaderships, results that have benefited Americans across the country with higher wages and better lives. So I think it's a good contrast, and it's a winning formula. Now, here's the great part of this, because we've been talking about for the last couple of days how wages are actually declining. You know, working people's wages are actually going down. The tax cuts went predominantly 83 cents out of every dollar to the top 1%. So I'm going, what the hell is she talking about? What kind of crack is she smoking? And I know you live in this world where you keep telling the lie. You keep telling the lie. You keep hammering the lie. Things are better. Things are better. Unemployment's low. You're better. You're better off. Even though people are struggling to make ends meet. I talk to people every day who go, you know what? It's getting harder and harder. There, a woman just wrote a book that, you know, to be in the middle class is 50%, 30 to 50% more expensive today than it was 20 years ago. But here's the thing. You know, she's like, nope, everything's great. And we've gotten results. And I'm going, what results? You ran on repeal and replace healthcare. That's what you ran on. Not only could you not repeal it, you had nothing to replace it with in the event that you did repeal it. Understand, that's people's number one issue. The number one issue, healthcare. And they've done nothing but, through executive order, make things worse. Through regulatory inefficiency, through incompetence, or through sheer, we're just going to destroy it, have made things worse. Which is why, you know, you look at this latest Vox poll out, or this latest Quinnipiac poll, that points out that 50%, 58% of Americans believe Trump isn't doing enough to help the middle class. That includes women and non-white voters. Black voters, 87% think they've done nothing for the middle class. Even the true blue, you know, white voters without college degrees, they're even the majority saying, 49% say he's not doing anything, not doing enough to help. 46%, I don't know what the hell they're looking at. The 46% who think he is, I have no idea. I have no idea what it is that they're going, yep, things are better. Other than we're just hating on people. Because for most working people, the economy is not getting better. Sorry. And this is not the winning we were promised. Anybody think this is the kind of winning that we're buying into? Not winning. Just kind of throwing that out there. Anyway, lots to get to. Today is the 83rd birthday for Social Security. And, you know, I go back to some of the Republicans' talking points back at the beginning, because I remember reading a lot about, you know, about this stuff. And I come up with the reality that we were told everything was going to fail. It was going to be the end. It was all over. This was going to be horrible. It was going to be the end of humanity. It was going to bankrupt us. Social Security was going to be a huge failure. And here we are, just 83 short years later. And it's lifted millions of people out of poverty. So we'll talk about that. Lots to get to. The signing of the National Defense Authorization Act. Also, you know, a little later, we'll talk about Donald Trump's star on the Walk of Fame as well. Also love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
10% of the wealth. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day the International Longshoremen's and Warehousemen's Union was founded. After the victorious strike of 1934 that established the Union Hiring Hall, West Coast union leaders embarked on an inland campaign to organize the thousands of warehouse workers who handled shipped goods. But West Coast dock workers overwhelmingly chose to join the CIO after it was expelled from the AFL earlier that year. They found that the ILA planned to abandon the warehouse workers they had worked so hard to organize. They also opposed dues assessments to fight the CIO and disagreed with the ILA's hostility to minimum wage laws, Social Security, and unemployment insurance. Radicals like Harry Bridges and others had established themselves not only as workers' leaders, but also led attacks on Jim Crow racism in the ranks and in the industry. The success of the 1934 strike was due in part to the welcoming of blacks into the ranks of the union. In his book, Workers on the Waterfront, historian Bruce Nelson notes that, quote, "The ILWU's well-known opposition to racial discrimination was an important factor in the union's expansion into Hawaii, not only on the waterfront, but among sugar and pineapple plantation workers. The triumph of the ILWU in Hawaiian agriculture brought about a degree of fraternization across racial lines that few had thought possible. Since then, the union has beat back numerous Taft-Hartley and McCarthy-era attacks. More recently, the ILWU has been in the forefront of broader social justice struggles, leading walkouts and work stoppages for various political causes. Today, it represents close to 60,000 workers, including those locals that initially refused to affiliate. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
So 83 years, Social Security has been the law of the land. And in all of that time, you've had a Republican Party seeking at every turn to destroy it, to defund it, to steal from it. And look, at the end of it, it's made it through. 83. Now, I look at still the attacks coming. Ted Cruz actually has a plan for paid leave. And how are we going to pay for it? By stealing from Social Security. That seems to be the honeypot. Reagan spent a lot of Social Security money for his Star Wars plan. That seems to be the honeypot that they love to dip into. And, you know, people, you know, looked at Al Gore in the lockbox idea as he was crazy. Personally, something we should still be doing. But here to talk about the 83rd anniversary of Social Security, I've asked Nancy Altman to come talk with us. She's the president of Social Security Works. She's also an author, has written the book, released today, The Truth About Social Security, The Founder's Words, Refute Revisionist History, Zombie Lies, and Common Misunderstandings. Nancy, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much for having me, and happy 83rd birthday. Social Security was signed into law this very day, August 14th, 1935.
And all along, it's going to destroy. And in fact, what we're telling kids is you're going to see a UFO before you see a Social Security check.
You know, one of the reasons I call it these zombie lies is because they've been recurrent throughout history. The first person who called the $2.9 trillion surplus that Social Security has accrued, IOUs, was not George W. Bush, though he called it that. It was Alf Landon back in 1936. So they keep saying these greedy geezers, these are not new lies. They've been with us a long time.
Yeah, I always loved the George Bush thing, you know, because he's seen them. He's seen the IOUs. They're down in the filing cabinets in the basement. And I'm going, really? Have you actually seen the IOUs that say Social Security IOU?
Well, there's actually a funny story about that, and that is there was the longest-serving actuary of Social Security devoted his life to it. When they were changing Treasury, most people, when you buy a Treasury bond backed by the full faith and credit of the United States, you don't get a paper at all. It's just electronic.
You get a number.
Number. And this Robert Myers, the first actuary who started with Social Security in 1934, put in the law, he insisted that Social Security get an actual document because he thought that would give people confidence. And there you had George Bush doing just the opposite.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty remarkable what they've attempted to do over the years. And I'm of the mindset and I'm of the belief that, you know, because we've allowed businesses to destroy defined benefit retirement plans, we're setting ourselves up as a nation for a major retirement crisis, which is why Social Security needs to be strengthened where it needs to be, but also expanded where we can to make sure we don't have poverty, seniors living in poverty, eating cat food, living on a street corner.
Absolutely. We have a retirement income crisis that Social Security is a solution to. We have immoral levels of wealth and income inequality. Social Security is a solution to that. Back in the 1920s, we had this kind of income inequality. And what did we do? We enacted Social Security, we enacted minimum wage, and we protected workers' right to collectively bargain.
Yeah, but we did all of that stuff after a massive depression with pain and suffering and starvation and job and home loss and all of that stuff. We had to do the misery first before we got to the more socialist stuff. Because, you know, I don't know if you've been noticing, but the Fox News and their ilk, they've been pushing the, we don't need more socialism. You know, socialism like that Social Security, because it's in the name after all.
That's right. I mean, I laugh because in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, there were always a small, you know, list group of ideologues and plutocrats who hated Social Security, but they were honest about it and said, this is not a great, you know, this is socialism. What today, you've got no politician. They want to save it. They want to fix it. And really, as I say, Social Security is a solution. What today's plutocrats want to do is undermine our confidence in Social Security, but it is a very strong program and will be there as long as the American people want it.
Now, I understand there might be some problems long term. If we do nothing, correct me if I'm wrong, because I want to make sure that we get this right. I'm told that for the next 20 years or so, 100% of what we're owed is paid out, up to that. But after that, it's like 75%. It drops down to on infinitum forever. And if we do nothing, that drop happens. Is that right?
Well, yes, but the drop won't happen. I mean, the another way to think about it is Social Security is fully paid for the next 16 years. It's 93% funded for the next 25 years, and it's about 88% funded for the next 50 years. Now, whenever you're projecting way out, of course you're sometimes going to show, unintended surpluses, unintended shortfalls.
Sure.
What we need to do is make the very wealthy pay their fair share, which they're not now doing, and Social Security can pay all benefits. In fact, as you say, we should be expanding Social Security. We're the wealthiest country in the world. Our benefits are very modest. We should be expanding it and requiring the wealthiest among us, who have done so well, to contribute their fair share. And then we can pay Social Security throughout the 21st century and beyond.
Yeah, I've often said, lower the rate a little bit, expand it to every dime of income, change what we consider to be income, capital gains, bank interest, whatever. Anything that comes in is considered income. Tax that at 100% for everybody. And lower the rate. And I think it solves a lot of our problems and acts as a stimulus.
Yes, absolutely. We could raise benefits if we did all of that. And we should be adding benefits. Most other countries, and in fact, the founders, thank you for mentioning my book, the founders were very bold. They assumed that what we now call Medicare for All was right around the corner. They thought we should have paid medical leave, that should be part of Social Security. We should have paid parental leave. All of those should be added to Social Security, and the level of benefits should be increased.
Yeah, well, they should have done it then, damn it, because...
Well, it's true. They, but they were pragmatic, and they wanted, called it a cornerstone on which to build, and they didn't want it. Don't forget, this was a time before internet, before smartphones, even before electric typewriters and fax machines and so forth, and copiers. And it was a huge undertaking, and they wanted to make sure it was successful. And then they assumed we would build on it. And we did build on it for a while. First, we had World War II, but in 1939, life insurance was added. In 1956, disability insurance was added. In 1965, the beginning of Medicare for All was added, Medicare for seniors. 1972, We had the program was indexed, and we extended Medicare to people with disabilities. But then we got Ronald Reagan telling us that government was not the solution, was the problem. Democrats, fortunately, are, I think, rediscovering their roots, and they are running on expanding Social Security, Medicare for all, getting the government to lower our drug prices.
Yeah, it's about time. It's about time, because this is stuff I've been talking about for years and hoping that the Democrats would run with and not away from. And I said from the beginning, you know, the ACA, while not perfect, was the beginning, in my view, of what we did with Medicare. At the beginning, Medicare was not great. But over time, when people took ownership of it, we made it to what it is today, where when my grandmother was alive, if you'd have threatened to take her Medicare away, she'd beat you with her walker.
And as well she should, because it was a benefit she had earned. And you're exactly right, but although I still say better late than never. I mean, they lost their way, but I think they're finding their way back. And the important thing is the American people are with them. This is very wise policy. It's also winning politics. So let's hope we're on the road to expanding Social Security and Medicare for all.
Yeah, I'm with you. So let me ask you this, because Ted Cruz has come out with this idea of paid leave. And the idea is steal from Social Security.
Yes.
I think it's a horrible idea. I think it's a poison pill. I'm curious your thought.
I couldn't agree with you more. Absolutely. And it is such an outrageous thing to do. Of course we should have paid parental leave. We should have paid medical leave, but not at the expense of Social Security. They're asking the question, okay, do you want to be economically insecure when you're young or when you're old or both? You know, I mean, it's ridiculous. We are, as they say, we are the wealthiest country in the world at the wealthiest moment in our history. Most other industrialized countries have much higher benefits and provide all of these benefits. In fact, the countries that spend the most on seniors also spend the most on children. Those that spend the least spend the least, and we're among the ones who spend the least. We should not be borrowing against our families are not better off if our grandparents are in poverty, and our country, our nation is not better off if young people cannot come out of school with all kinds of debt and starting a family do not get paid leave. It's just wrong, and it should change.
Now, I'd agree with you, but hey, we got billionaires we got to pay for. They've got 7 and 8 houses that they need. They got yachts to pay for. Come on, have a heart.
Well, in fact, the point I always make, what those plutocrats have not, and they're literal billionaires who've been trying, the Koch brothers and Pete Peterson have been trying to just tear down Social Security. And the way they do it is to try to undermine our confidence. Oh, we can't afford it. Oh, it's, you know, greedy geezers and all of this. But the answer is whether we expand Social Security and add Medicare for all, whether we cut them, is a question of values, not affordability. And
right.
It is exactly the value you're talking about. Do we want more upward redistribution of wealth, which has been what's been going on for the last 20 or 30 years? Or do we want to share the productivity that we all contribute to?
Well, as I pointed out this morning, you know, since 1973, productivity has skyrocketed. I mean,
yeah.
It's one of those things where you go, it's just so out of control. In fact, you know, since 73, productivity shot up 74%. Wage increases have only gone up 13%. Somewhere that 61%. Went, and it didn't
yes.
go to us. It didn't go to working people. It went to yachts and 7th and 8th homes.
Absolutely, and it's just wrong. I mean, we all contribute to the productivity of this country, and we should all share in it. And the way to do that is to require the millionaires and billionaires to pay their fair share, which they are not doing now.
Let me ask you this, because you know I've had arguments with conservatives, and some of them truly, to their core, believe that they're right when it comes to Social Security. They want to do to Social Security exactly what corporate America has done to defined benefit plans, that everyone gets their own little account, you get your own little 401k, and Wall Street will take care of it, and you're going to be much better off at the end. Do you buy that they really internally, but that the people at the top? Do you buy that the Koch brothers actually believe that we would be better off with the system that has screwed us so badly in the private sector? Or do you think it's really just about getting the money and having control of that system?
I think it's the latter. I think that because it's very easy to poke holes in that argument. I mean, you need to have it, what you need is insurance, not savings. You need something you can won't outlive, and so you need life insurance, disability insurance, and guaranteed income for the rest of your life and at retirement, and that's what Social Security provides. You know, the ideologues have never been able to win on what they really believe. It's two things that are causing. There's a President Eisenhower called them a tiny splinter group. They are just a very small percentage of the population who don't like Social Security.
And called them stupid.
And he said their number is negligible and they are stupid. And it was in a letter to his brother.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was right. And the point is that the people who don't like Social Security, it's ideological. It's also, you know how much of Social Security's money goes to Wall Street and fees? Zero. You know how much would be going if we had private accounts? Like 10 or 15% if we were lucky, probably even higher. So the point is that they tried in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and the 60s to say, this is socialism, this isn't what government should be doing. And the American people said, we disagree, because there are many issues the nation is polarized, but not Social Security. We have polls that show Tea Partiers agree with union members, Republicans with Democrats. When asked, do you think Social Security should be cut? No. Do you think it's more important than ever? Yes. Do you want to see it expanded? Yes. So they've changed and said, oh, we love Social Security, but you know what? Wouldn't you rather have the money in your pocket and you could, you know?
No, they come up with new and innovative ways to destroy it.
Exactly.
And then they try and con us and to think that we're doing well, which is why I think your book is so important, and I hope people will take a look at it. The book is The Truth About Social Security, The Founder's Words, Refute Revisionist History, Zombie Lies, and Common Misunderstandings, written by Nancy Altman. Nancy, I appreciate the time, the thoughts. Happy 83rd Social Security birthday, and I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thank you so much.
Fantastic stuff. We'll make sure that we get a link out so people can take a look at the book. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1936. That was the day that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act into law. The act was a key piece of the president's New Deal, a series of federal programs responding to the ravages of the Great Depression. Social Security would provide an income for retirees and the disabled to ensure that they did not slide into complete destitution. On signing the bill, President Roosevelt, known for delivering memorable speeches, addressed the press. He said, quote, "Today, the hope of many years standing in large part fulfilled. The civilization of the past 100 years, with its startling industrial changes, has tended more and more to make life insecure. Young people have come to wonder what will their lot when they come to old age. The man with a job has wondered how long that job will last. This Social Security measure gives at least some protection to 50 million of our citizens who will reap direct benefits through unemployment compensation, through old age pensions, and through increased services for the protection of children and the prevention of ill health." He went on to say, quote, "The law will flatten out the peaks and valleys of deflation and inflation. It is, in short, a law that will care of human needs and at the same time provide the United States an economic structure of vastly greater soundness." Over the past few decades, politicians have increasingly sounded the alarm that Social Security will not remain viable as the large baby boomer generation retires and draws benefits. Yet despite those who seek to attack Social Security, it remains a bedrock of the social safety net for millions of Americans. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Fun and busy day of Twitter insanity. Look, Trump just can't leave it alone. It's gonna dig himself deeper and good. We need it now. Is Amoroso the or Amorosa? Is she gonna be the one who brings him down? No, his base doesn't care what's on the tapes. If grabbing her by the you know what didn't take him down, nothing that she has to offer is going to make his base walk away from him at this point. And if he did say the N-word, it's only going to solidify the hero status with the base, in my view. But we will see as time plays along. And here to share some thoughts on what's going on around the world and in Washington, D.C., Luke Vargas, Chief Foreign Correspondent for Talk Media News. Luke, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. Glad to be with you.
So what's our take on the I guess Trump suing Omarosa on these breaching a non-disclosure agreement in government? What's going on?
It seems like the suit here, which is coming from the campaign, is probably just designed to give her cold feet about doing anything more in the public eye, because as far as I've been able to understand it, these NDAs aren't actionable when you're in public office. That, you know, so basically this to me seems like a pretty clear attempt, and Trump has retained a lawyer who's going to be suing her on this. That is just to try to make her think that, hey, you know, I'm going to be tied up in more legal fees than I'm going to make in book revenue if I go ahead with this. But as far as Omarosa being free to release more tapes about, you know, or just talk about her time in the White House, she seems to be free to do that.
No, I mean, there's no way these non-disclosure agreements can hold up when you're talking about working for we the people. And I would even argue that even during the campaigns, being very public and being, you know, part of, you know, our entire process, I don't even know that they should be allowed to use those during those. But this is just Trump's MO. It's exactly what he's done. Now, the other question is, do we care? Should we care? Should this be something that we even spend 5 minutes on?
If I had to say, let's prioritize Omarosa and questions about even whether the president used a racial slur versus should we still be asking follow-ups about why we don't know what Putin and Trump talked about in Helsinki, I would say much more important to be probing on those critical foreign policy questions than getting distracted by this. Even if a tape surfaces and we all wring our hands and say this has got to be what causes Trump to resign, and then obviously Trump doesn't resign, and nor do any of his senior staffers. What do we benefit from that? Whereas if we can, I don't know. It just seems like there are obviously bigger fish out there. What it does say though, I think is pretty clear. One is exceedingly obvious, which is that the office doesn't matter to the inhabitants of the presidential office and those who have the privilege of working at the White House. That you'd think, as you mentioned to me off air, that Omarosa has a reputation of sort of being someone who's surreptitiously recorded things her entire life. Fine, but you'd think, hey, you know, I just got a position at the White House. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I'm serving the American people. I'm going to go in and I'm not going to be up to my old self-serving ways. Well, obviously, Omarosa didn't make that change in calculation, nor did President Trump change his pretty shoddy hiring criteria when he became president. You know, according to Sarah Sanders in a briefing on Tuesday, basically saying, look, the president hired Omarosa despite some concerns about her behavior because he wanted to give her a second chance. I mean, should you be using key American taxpayer jobs for second chances? I don't know.
I mean, come on, do you believe that? I mean, honestly, truthfully, do you think Trump is the kind of guy who doles out second chances? I mean, seriously.
Well, even the fact that the lie is still so problematic shows you that the truth has got to be worse. Yeah. And finally, I guess, just all comes down to, this White House is incapable, it seems, of defending American security from these people brought in off the street who don't know what they're doing. I mean, as far as I've had it explained to me, the White House Situation Room has guards out front, but they don't have a wand like they do at the TSA, and they're not scanning you to check for things. When you go inside the room, there are cubbies, sort of Faraday cages or whatever, things that make it impossible for foreign governments to tap into your phone and listen to what's happening. But the White House apparatus is sort of it's built on trust. The idea being, if you've been fortunate enough to get one of these high-ranking positions, that you don't need to be, have the nanny state looking over you and going through your pockets. Well, of course, Trump's, set such a low bar for the people coming into that office that we maybe now should rethink those standards. And it's scary to think there could have been incredibly sensitive national secrets that Omarosa's, wireless recording pen could have been picking up. And if, God forbid, a foreign adversary knew Omarosa had, vulnerable technologies on her, that's the precise risk we try to mitigate against. So he's just letting in people who obviously lack the right skill sets to be in these incredibly powerful jobs.
Yeah, I keep questioning, why they took her in there in the first place, why she was in the Situation Room at all. I mean, she was almost nobody. I mean, she worked in the White House, but she didn't really have any important job. Why was she in the Situation Room?
I have no idea why. And there's some weird stories about her being fired in the Situation Room as well. It's just, why not just do it in Kelly's office or her office?
Why not meet her at the front gate?
No,
do like every other employer does nowadays. Send her a text. That's the weird thing, because, I talked about this yesterday. In 2013, we had done our labor history tour, and we ended up at the George W. Bush Presidential Library. And Bush stole the Situation Room, the old Situation Room, and they recreated it in his presidential library. And we got to go in there and do a bunch of interviews and talk to the curators and all this stuff. And, as the guy explained to me, and I remember this, he goes, this at one point was the most secure room in the entire country. And he was going on how the Situation Room is, the brain, and it's where all the technology comes to. Even, in horrible, atrocious acts, this is, secure. And to have this happen after, hearing that just kind of makes me go, this the person who occupies the White House right now and the people that work for him, none of them belong there.
Yeah. Well, it's a pay for access or flatter for access kind of administration, and when that's the operating rules, then you have a bunch of
it's
essentially
crazy
tourists who start having White House gigs,
she had her wedding photos there.
Yeah,
which you go, really? Okay. You just decided one day we're gonna show up with the wedding clan and take a big picture?
Oh,
all right.
I didn't even know about that.
you do what you get away with, I guess. Let's move on. Evidently, the president of Turkey has called to boycott all U.S. consumer electronics. What's going on there?
Yeah, I doubt this is going to dent Apple's $1 trillion valuation very much if they lose the Turkish market. I mean, look, so we've got a trade dispute between these two countries. Ostensibly, it's about national security and wanting to protect our steel and aluminum industries. It's pretty clear, I think, as we look at the fact that the president's going harder after Turkey than really any other country in that steel and aluminum tariff sort of group. But this has a lot to do with this one, American pastor who's being imprisoned there and held on terrorism charges, that we have basically thrust this very important, if not friendly, U.S.-Turkey alliance into chaos over this one detention, and that to me is sort of an inflection point. We've got to really ask ourselves, who is setting this policy in the U.S. that we are, stewing up a big, fissure within NATO over this one issue. And are we prepared? And the answer may well be yes. And I'm not trying to say we have to not change the relationship just to keep the status quo. But we have to acknowledge, though, what might the consequences be for our foreign policy more broadly around the Middle East if we sever the relationship with Turkey or erode it so much so that counterterrorism and other sorts of security cooperation becomes difficult. The Turkish currency is in major trouble, and their president, Recep Erdogan, I think feels very vulnerable here. And he is in power because he's been able to, since he came into office in 2002, stir up a lot of nationalist sentiment within Turkey. And so saying, hey, we're gonna build everything that we normally import and we're going to make it better and then export it, and that's preposterous. There's the Turkey's cell phone manufacturer is not going to make a better iPhone. But it is precisely the thing that he needs to say to fire up his base. But I would say, stepping back, we've got to seriously consider whether or not the case of one imprisoned person in Turkey, though it is obviously a serious matter that an American citizen is being held there on what seem like absurd charges, is that enough of a reason to single out Turkey and throw into chaos this NATO alliance? I think we need to have a discussion about that, if indeed that's what is, if it's religiously fueled, the decision to provoke this trade war.
Yeah, I mean, but I look at this, and you know, the other part of it is, as you point out, I think it's all over the pastor. I don't think it has anything really to do with the trade. I just don't see this being that kind of an issue that would throw that relationship into chaos. Outside of, I worry about, you think about our Air Force needs that base. As I recall, going into Iraq and going to Afghanistan, we kind of need that. And don't they know that?
Well, yeah, but that brings me to another story from today, which is these reports from the United Nations that there may still be as many as 30,000 Islamic State soldiers within Iraq and Syria, not UN numbers, but numbers reported to the UN and compiled by countries in the region. Essentially giving us a picture that, yes, President Trump is fulfilling his campaign promise. He's winding down this fight against the Islamic State. I certainly appreciate his push to try and defeat that terror group and bring that conflict to a tidy conclusion. And yet one wonders if we are declaring the risk of the Islamic State in this region to be over prematurely as a way of hitting that campaign promise. And if these reports are correct, and there are 20 to 30,000 Islamic State fighters laying in wait, embedded in civilian populations, much as they were before the, I think, 2014 push to create the caliphate, then the conditions exist for Islamic State to return to Iraq and Syria. And if we need to go back there and wage a similar campaign to knock them out again, but we do so without Turkey as an ally in that fight, we will be significantly constrained in what we can do. And right. So that again, it puts me in an awkward spot to feel like I need to, or even sounds like I'm advocating for just sort of a continuous military campaign against these terror groups, which I don't think is sustainable, at least in some of the ways we've done it in the past. But at the same time, I think we have been careful in our dealings with Turkey because, though we disagree on many things, we also realize there is no real alternative to having them as a partner for many of our foreign policy goals. So it's a little nerve-wracking to see such an important relationship hinging on one issue, and particularly one issue that is of incredible sensitivity to the Turks, and I don't think they're going to cave easily on it.
No, I mean, look, I'm of the mindset, declare victory, get out. Because they're always going to be there. You're never going to eradicate
them. Sure.
I don't ever see that threat going away. The military-industrial complex needs it because, hey, got to keep us afraid of it. So we keep spending, billions of dollars on defense and on air toys and all of that stuff. It's never going to end. Never.
Yeah. And look, this UN report, which sort of looks at al-Qaeda and Islamic State strength in many regions, shows us this is a threat that keeps there's entropy, terrorist entropy, right? I mean, we've now got some of the military leaders from Islamic State in Iraq and Syria have gone to Afghanistan, where they now see fertile ground. There are cells popping up in there have been for many years in Libya, other parts of Northern Africa. the Philippines. It just keeps going on and on. So this, it is the sort of a perpetual war footing against these terror groups, if you want it to be. But that, I ultimately think, should be a choice that we consciously make. It's just doing things unconsciously is the most dangerous.
Yeah, good point. Let's move on. Evidently, a major investigation by the AP finds, I think, what we all already knew, that Google can continue to track our cell phones, even if we turn off the GPS location services.
That's right. For many years, they had sort of pointed privacy activists and people concerned about their data to say, hey, you know, you don't like the fact that we're compiling this very, very precise recreation of all of your daily movements and storing it and doing what we want with it. Well, then you can turn off location settings. Turns out every time you still opened Google Maps and every time you did a search on Google on your mobile device, even with that setting off, Google would still capture your sort of IP address and your current location. So in many ways, they were still collecting tons of this data. Again, not quite the complete snapshot they were getting before, but this just, you know, it's just further evidence that I think these companies really do need to have a much greater oversight. I mean, this does seem like, I don't really know how you catch Google on this, because certainly people probably unwittingly signed up to this in some form or another, or they could argue that, but this does seem to be false advertising of some sort or something like that, where basically they were hiding very important permissions about how your Google apps were sharing your location information, but putting it behind settings and menus and stuff on your phone such that you would never think to look there. And now Google seems to sort of be giving what I view as a mea culpa, saying, okay, if you actually now want to turn off this data, here's what you do. They should have been saying that all along, and I think it's telling that they didn't do it before.
And I still believe when you turn it off, they can still turn it on and listen. I still believe they can listen, they can see, they can access anything they want at any point. And I know it sounds really conspiratorial, but I still believe that no matter what, they're able to access it at any time, and nobody's safe.
Yeah, in fact, my fiance just got a new iPhone, and the Siri is malfunctioning like crazy. It's an embarrassment. But we were playing around with it the other day, and I had been on a rant about something, and she then, in the middle of my rant, said, Siri, like how many, you know, milliseconds are in an hour or something like that? And that phrasing was there, how many milliseconds are in the hour? But on the screen, before she even said Siri, it had a transcript of part of my rant that I was saying about a different topic. And so Siri completely bugged out and said, I don't understand exactly how, you know, Rodrigo Duterte, how many milliseconds in an hour or whatever. But you can realize, oh, yeah, that's everything I was just saying from 10 feet away is getting transcribed by and stored by that phone in case you wake it up by Siri. But I think the Google thing shows us, as many people have joked in the past, turning the location services off on the phone merely prevents you from seeing how your data is being used, much like Siri is listening, but only just deciding to show us at certain times the transcripts of our own conversation here. So we've really, I think, got to have a reckoning about this.
Yeah, well, at some point, you know, I had a conversation with, you know, with a kid the other day, and I go, you know, eventually your generation will become Luddites, and you will smash the machine. And he's like, no, I love my iPhone. I can't imagine life without it. And I go, you know, I pine for life before it, you know, so there you go. Let's move on. Evidently, a new report out by Reuters. Finally, evidently, China's much worse at monitoring their citizens than we are. Much more open about it.
Let's see. I mean, the report from Reuters here is about procurement of various sort of surveillance technologies by local police forces in China. And it shows, since really around 2015, this absolutely, you know, dramatic expansion in procurement dollars for technologies, and much like the facial recognition. You know, a lot of Chinese police departments have been working on this for years, basically, you know, traffic cameras that have incredibly wide ranges of view and identifying a face, attach to it your identity. And so you can see on the heads-up display at the police headquarters or whatever, exactly who is crossing the street and their name and age and stuff like that. And add to that the social score, which I'm sure you've talked about, that the Chinese are working on sort of a political compliance credit score type number that they're giving everyone in China based upon who you talk to, you know, what you're talking to them about.
If you're a troublemaker.
Right. So pair that together. What this is interesting, and it's become more and more common, particularly as you travel to parts of China the government is concerned about, is they have these devices that basically, you know, they say, okay, we're pulling you over or we're taking you off a train. Give us your phone. And they plug the phone into a little device and in the span of a few minutes, basically searches through every single thing on your phone. And the Chinese government and local police agencies have been working on procuring this software and these devices at a really accelerating rate. And they bust right through. You know, you're not sitting there writing down all your passwords. It just goes, cuts all through that. And it looks through your Gmails, your WeChats, your WhatsApps, and whatever. And it can really and take off any information that could be used as sort of evidence against you. We've all sort of feared, and journalists in particular are aware that devices like this, which sift through your electronics, exist at entry points into China already. I mean, that has been a concern for American business people for many years, that you can't travel to China with a patent or any sort of company property on your laptop because it's going to be lifted off of it electronically. But this is sort of taking that technology down to a local police car level where they will be able to do a spot check of whether or not you're in possession of something that's against the government. That is technology I hope is remains far away from our shores, but I'm not quite certain that's going to be the
case. I'm sure it's on its way. I'm sure someone will make the argument that we need to be safe. You just need to keep us safe. Because look, we've already got that kind of stuff going on already. You get on the turnpike here in Pennsylvania, it takes a picture of everyone's license plate and of you. So as you're going through, it's collecting all of that information. Even if you have an easy pass, and this is the thing that drives me insane, they have this plate to toll program to where you don't need an easy pass anymore. You just blow through, and they'll take your license plate and they'll mail you a bill. They're taking your picture, your license plate information, and they're sending you a bill saying, "Hey, we know you were here," and I haven't seen anyone really revolting against it.
Yeah, it's funny. In Massachusetts, they have moved to basically a toll-less highway on the Mass Pike. And much as I am wary of too much surveillance of us, I think I haven't pushed back against that because the places where that highway used to bottleneck, now down by Boston University and all that stuff, I mean, it really is
it's convenient.
Clearing up. I mean, you don't, it's not even going through a toll at 20. Or even the reduced 45 when the overhead, it is just no tolls at all. And if that's the trade-off, then I may be okay making it. But something tells me the incentives are not going to be so great for everyday citizens when we're talking about, you know, lifting off all the contents of our cell phone cameras and all of our Google Drive attachments. And that's where I don't think we get very much in return for handing over that information.
Well, the good thing is you're okay with, you know, zooming through at 65 and having them either take a picture of your license plate or charge you, or, you know, charging your easy pass, because then they can take that technology to just about every road in the entire country, and cha-ching, 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 no matter where you go, you're reaching in your pocket.
Well, sometimes I just pray that the complexity of America combination of laziness and revulsion to authority and all these things conspire to prevent that world from ever existing. And we just sort of fumble along in some weird futuristic status, somewhat status quo. But I don't know that that's
right. Good stuff.
Maybe we got to leave the cities for that to happen, because that doesn't really look like most of American metropolis anymore.
Yeah, we're going to be forced underground. You know, all those 1980s movies, being forced underground, it's going to come true. It's coming true.
I'm going to go grab a silo now and start renovating, and I'll give you an invite.
You can be a prepper. Thanks so much. Good stuff. Luke, appreciate the time, man.
You're welcome. Take care.
As always, our good friend Luke Farkas, Talk Media News. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hello, I'm David Philman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing. So is your labor union. We are AFSCME.